Hi, this is Mimi Sheraton, author of 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die, and you are listening to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm Carrie Diamond, editorial director of Cherry Bomb, the indie magazine about women and food. It's a busy time at Cherry Bomb headquarters. We're finishing the planning for our Jubilee conference, which we've expanded to 2 days this year because we're crazy. So we have Jubilee on Saturday the 8th, and then our first ever marketplace on Sunday the 9th. It's going to be a great weekend, and if you're coming, please say hi. I always love to know who's listening to the show. Otherwise, I feel like I'm sitting in here in a little box just talking to myself. So good to put faces to viewers. And let's see, special thanks to our sponsor, Kerrygold. If you are looking for a little indulgence, check out Kerrygold Irish Cream Liqueur, a premium blend of natural cream, real chocolate, and aged Irish whiskey that was named World's Best Cream Liqueur at the 2016 World Drinks Awards. Enjoy it over ice, in some coffee, or create your own specialty cocktail. This season of Radio Cherry Bomb is also sponsored by Le Cordon Bleu, the legendary culinary school with locations around the globe, from Paris to London to Ottawa. The schools have a wide array of programs available, from 9-month classical culinary training programs all the way to bachelor and master's degrees. Or, how about one of their 3-hour master classes on everything from baking the most delicious macaroons to making that perfect sauce? Visit cordonbleu.edu for more. Dave, what do you think? Should we run away to culinary school?
Let's do it. I'm with you.
Tomorrow. Oh, no, wait. I have to stay here for Jubilee.
Today.
After Jubilee. After Jubilee.
It's today or nothing, Carrie.
Okay, you have to go by yourself. Our next guest is Kim Malik, the co-founder of one of America's fastest-growing ice cream brands, Salt and Straw. She and her cousin Tyler launched the business in TK. That's really useful. Kim, what year?
2011.
2011. And today they have 9 locations in LA and Portland, and they'll be adding San Francisco very soon. No less an authority than our friend Charlotte Druckman wrote in the Wall Street Journal that Salt and Straw ice cream is the new standard to beat. They have flowers like flowers. Oh my God.
We do make ice cream with flowers, so that's not a bad thing.
There are flowers in front of me. There are these beautiful hyacinths, and usually it smells like a boys' locker room in the Heritage Radio studio, and today it smells like flowers. Anyway, you have flavors like bone marrow with smoked cherry, strawberry honey balsamic with cracked black pepper, and sea salt with caramel ribbons. Kim Malik, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thanks for making the trip. What are you doing in New York right now?
Oh, you know, we came out to New York as part of this group of chefs who have come as a part of this Travel Portland thing.
Oh, cool.
We served lunch at Gramercy Tavern yesterday and just kind of meeting with different folks to spread the good word about Portland.
So you aren't originally from Portland.
I'm not. I grew up in Billings, Montana.
But your brand was born in Portland.
Absolutely was.
Did I read you moved to Portland for love?
I did. I had lived in Portland in the mid-90s.
And oh, you did?
Yeah.
And, like, tail end of grunge?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And we were, I always wanted to move back. So I was living in Seattle at the time. And actually, I was about to move to New York for my job. And I went to Portland for the weekend for a birthday party. And I met a guy in a bar, which doesn't usually end well. But we're still together and have 3 kids and launched an ice cream company.
Oh, that's amazing. So where do we even start? So your cousin Tyler is your business partner.
He is.
In this. And you had a bunch of corporate jobs, right? Do you want to say where your corporate jobs
were?
Well,
I mean, I started working in the early days at Starbucks Coffee. There were 30 stores when I started, and I was straight out of college, and my parents thought I didn't get a very good job. They were really worried about me, and I was like, no, this is going to be big someday. This guy's for real, this Howard Schultz guy. And so I worked there for quite a while they were, you know, we were growing the company, and I think I learned enough to be dangerous about how to run a business, and I went on to work at a few other companies. Last I was working at RED, which is the company Bono started to raise money for AIDS in Africa. That's what was bringing me to New York before I fell in love. So.
Got it. So let's go back to Starbucks for a second. What an incredible time to be at Starbucks.
Yeah, it was. It was amazing.
I have a lot of admiration for what Howard Schultz is doing today.
Yeah, I know. I think he was setting a whole new standard back in the day in terms of offering health insurance for all of his employees and stock options. I mean, I started as a barista and I had stock options when the company went public. And so innovative.
That's
then.
Rough.
Well, I cashed him in early. So I think I bought a couch or something, but
okay,
I bought my first house actually with that. But yeah, now he's employing veterans and immigrants and putting people through college
and has one of the best paternity and maternity leave programs
yeah.
or policies in the U.S., let alone in food.
That's right. I mean, when I originally wrote our little business plan for our one shop on Alberta Street, a lot of what I put into that I learned at Starbucks, and it was all about putting people first. And so we've tried to do a lot of those things, too, on our own level.
Amazing. So I read that you were on Facebook, and you happened to see your cousin Tyler posted that he wanted to move to Portland.
Yeah.
So tell us what happened after that.
So Tyler, I come from a pretty big family. I'm the oldest cousin of 14 and the only girl. And so
what?
Tyler's much younger than me, I have to admit.
You have 13 guy cousins?
Yeah, they're all guy cousins, including my brother.
And your brothers, right.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah. So we, he and I mean, we knew each other, but we weren't super close. And he had posted on Facebook that he wanted to go to culinary school and he was thinking about coming to Portland. And I said, well, if you come to Portland, you can stay with me. And I got a phone call within like a half hour, and he said, yeah, I'd love to stay with you. And throughout the conversation, he found out that I was just getting this idea going to start an ice cream shop in Portland. And he would not give up until I agreed to work with him. I mean, starting a company seems so crazy and scary to me. Like, I certainly didn't want to bring my family into it with me. And I thought he could have a much brighter future on his own. And so I kind of kept putting that off. And in the meantime, he bought ice cream makers at the Goodwill and started testing recipes and mailing them, you know, the recipes and the feedback he was getting to me. And he finally said, okay, I won't make ice cream. I will run errands. Can I just please help you? And within a couple of days, he was living in my basement and making ice cream in my kitchen. And it turns out he's pretty good.
I mean, that sounds like a story that could go bad really fast.
Yeah.
My cousin's living in my basement.
It wasn't a nice basement either, I'm not going to lie. I don't even think we have windows down there.
Maybe he had the Starbucks couch to sleep on.
That's probably right. I don't know if we even have that anymore. It wasn't a pullout.
Where did the name Salt and Straw come from?
You know, my partner, Mike, his sister-in-law came up with it, Sandy Ryan, and we were sitting around talking about, I mean, our intention was to have this one little shop, and we were going to make ice cream in 5-gallon batches, which we still do today. And so she had done some research to figure out that back in the day, at the turn of the century, they would put rock salt in the ice when they would churn it so that it would get colder and they could hand crank. And then they would pack it on straw out in the barn to keep it cold. So Salt and Straw was sort of a nod to that. I had a customer come back from a tour at Monticello, and he was like, you're telling the truth. I heard you know, they talk about this on the tour. So it was just sort of a nod to how ice cream was born in the United States.
I haven't thought about this in 100 years, but I just had a memory flash in my head of being at Girl Scout camp and making ice cream in coffee cans.
Yeah. Oh, really?
With rock salt.
Oh.
Yeah. And we would just roll it around.
With rock salt.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
I mean, I remember it being kind of like a slushy ice cream that resulted, but it was really tasty. And, you know, when you're a child, that's magic.
It's like science. I know we do these projects once a year with the elementary school closest to each of our shops, and the kids coming up with ice cream flavors and ice cream memories. It just blows their mind as a kid.
Oh, I have so many ice cream memories.
Mm.
The biggest is Baskin Robbins being, I don't know, like 8 or 9. And the idea that you had to choose one of 33 flavors,
yes,
like short circuited my little brain all the time.
That's the great thing about coming to Salt and Straw. I love seeing the little kids come in there and they will try every single flavor. And by little kids, I mean huge grown-up adults too. And, mm-hmm. But I know, I love that.
There was this one disgusting flavor they had called pink bubblegum. Do you remember that?
That was my flavor.
I ordered that all the time. And when I think back, I'm like, what a repulsive
flavor. You literally
flavor.
Were filled your mouth with a chunk of gum when you were done with it.
And it was like what the color of Pepto-Bismol. It's pretty funny. Okay, so you get this, you're getting this ice cream company off the ground. You go and you meet with, walk us through this part, but the Oregon Food Innovation Center?
Yeah. So, I mean, Portland is so great in terms of kind of helping. We didn't even know how great it was until we started to open in other cities and found out that all these resources aren't available everywhere you go. And so one is this great program that the Oregon State University and the Oregon Department of Ag have come together to create the Food Innovation Center. And
wait, go back one sec. The Oregon Department of Ag?
Of course. Agriculture. They
of ag. Wait,
not
A-G?
Eggs, but
not
egg.
Eggs. Oh,
yeah.
Okay. I thought you meant eggs. I was like, E-G-G?
We don't even use eggs in our ice cream.
I was like, that's hardcore. If Oregon has a whole department of eggs. The Department of Ag. Got it.
Yes, the Department of Ag. And they, the reason they came together was to help help support companies that are getting started who are going to support local farmers. So it's this cool way to tap into this great food science department that they have at Oregon State University, and then it's supported by the Department of Agriculture so that they can support, just further support and kind of have this natural cycle of goodness. As companies grow, they use more produce and all ships rise.
So I'm guessing Oregon Food Innovation Center shepherded a lot of brands.
Yeah, you know, they have. There's been a lot of entrepreneurs have come out of there in Portland, a few different ice cream makers, actually. And I think Oregon Chai worked there for a while, and Ruby Jewel, which is another Oregon ice cream company. They have the most state-of-the-art like R&D facilities. They literally have food scientists on staff who can help you get started.
That's phenomenal.
They'll be on the phone to the university at a drop of a hat if you have a question or you need help. It's like unbelievable resources for an entrepreneur who's just getting started, a food entrepreneur.
That's a really great resource. And so forward thinking of Oregon.
Yeah.
And now I'm wondering, does New York State have anything even comparable?
Yeah, we should check on that. I mean, it's a tremendous model. I mean, it's great. Yeah, it's great for everybody.
I'm going to call the governor later. Ask Andy if New York State has something like this. And if not, why not?
Why wouldn't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
We'll help. We'd love to help.
Okay. Stay tuned. So how was it opening that first location?
Well, you know, we first started as a cart. So we had a little push cart that we would roll from the back of this building, and we had it on a patio in front of a coffee shop just up the street from where our store ended up opening. And it ended up being, it was May, June of 2011. It ended up being the wettest spring and summer on record in the history of Oregon.
Of course it did.
So we're literally standing out there, like rain is coming down sideways. It's partially sleeting, and we're trying to sell this ice cream. The coffee shop guys, they would run out with tea and just felt so sorry for us. But people showed up, and it was a good way to kind of get to know the neighborhood and customers and also start making ice cream. And when we were learning what we were doing, right? I mean, Tyler moved on from his Goodwill ice cream makers, but he would make ice cream in the morning, bring it over to our little cart on top of his Subaru where I was standing there selling. And then he'd give me a break and sell for a little while. And he'd go to culinary school at night. Like it was a really, it was an intense situation. And then about 3 months later, we opened up the street at our first little store. And, you know, we had kind of 2010, 2011 wasn't a good time to find money with the economy in the state it was. And so I had done all this work to try to get a loan or find investors, and all of those ideas just fell flat. And so I remember one day I was sitting in my office at home looking through some files, and I saw this file that said 401k. And I thought, I do have some money. And I pulled that out and cashed that in, which they tell you is a terrible thing to do. And then, you know, sold everything I had, including like my scuba gear and golf clubs and my house, and just kind of eked together as much money as
you
we
sold
could.
Your house?
Yeah, I sold my house. I mean, it was in Seattle, and I was moving to Portland to be with Mike. So, but I sold that, and we were like $40,000 short right before we were going to open. And Mike and I hadn't even known each other for very long, and he came forth to guarantee this $40,000 loan. He had to put his house up as collateral. So he's looking at me going like, okay, you know, you better be good for this. And
that's true love.
That was true love. And I mean, that kind of stuff just makes me feel like, okay, I got to get up in the morning and really earn this. And we paid it off in under a year. So he got his house back clear.
Good for you. So you opened the first shop. It was very well received.
I
remember reading here about salt and straw and everybody being like, what is this salt and straw?
That's right.
What did everyone love so much about what you were doing?
You know, it was funny. The quote you read earlier from the Wall Street Journal popped up when we were still a cart. We were asked to send ice cream to New York City, which we didn't even know how to ship it in the mail. We had to figure that out. And then we heard back and she said, you know, my editor wants to know, I want to cover this and put it in the paper, but if you could have national distribution. And I said, I wish you could see me right now because I can touch both sides of my little cart. The ice cream was delivered on top of a Subaru earlier. Like, what does that national distribution mean? And she said, well, you know, like, could you ship or something? And I said, sure, we could ship. How hard could that be?
So this is Charlotte saying this to
yes.
you?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
So she said, okay, well, you have 3 weeks. The story's going to run in 3 weeks. And I literally started Googling, like, how do you start a mail order business? Up above from where our little cart was, there was this agency it was a digital agency, and this woman walked by and saw me Googling this, and she kind of helped me figure out how to start a Yahoo store or something, and we ended up shipping, and it all worked out just fine, and so we had that story. And you know, I think one of the funny things, when I wanted to start an ice cream shop in Portland, you know, I had lived there in the mid-90s, and I don't know if you spent much time in Portland, but it is so, the sense of community that I found there was really, really unique. And I always say it feels like people bring you in and raise you up. And for whatever reason, when I was living there in the 90s, I felt like an ice cream shop would be a good way to reflect that. And so I sort of lived in fear of that idea for many, many years. And when I moved back and started to work on this idea, That feeling of community was still really central to me, creating a place where people could run into their friends and family and spend time with neighbors and just that experience that you really have when you're in Portland. And so that sort of blossomed into the idea of how we made flavors. I mean, Tyler was learning, and I think I told him, maybe we should do a bacon and maple flavor or something. And he said, yeah, you know, Denny's has that on their menu right now. I can't do that. But he was hanging out with some brewers and thought, you know, a maple, instead of maple, we could do kind of like a brown ale that would be similar. And before he knew it, the brewers had him in the back room, and they were figuring out how to brew beer in ice cream. And the guys from Olympia Provisions came over, and they were helping us pick different meats and how to candy them and prepare them to put them in ice cream. So, like, this spirit of collaboration has bred, I think, these really kind of unexpected and different flavors. And so people have seemed to really respond to experiencing ice cream in a different way than they had imagined was possible. And it kind of was born from this idea of community.
On that note, we are going to take a quick break and hear a word from our sponsors, and then we'll be right back with Kim Malik from Salt and Straw. Spoil yourself with Kerrygold Irish Cream Liqueur. This delicious grown-up treat is a perfectly balanced blend of three ingredients: natural Irish cream from grass-fed cows, velvety rich real chocolate, and whiskey that has been distilled and matured in Ireland for at least 3 years. Try it straight over ice, channel your inner mixologist, and create your own specialty cocktail, or blend it with vanilla ice cream for the best adult milkshake you've ever had. Indulge in the smooth delight that is Kerrygold Irish Cream Liqueur. Le Cordon Bleu, the renowned culinary school, was founded in Paris 122 years ago by a young journalist named Mademoiselle de Stael. In 1895, she launched the first weekly culinary magazine called La Cuisinière Le Cordon Bleu. She invited subscribers to take part in free cooking lessons with the chefs featured in her magazine, and from there, the school was born. In the years since, Le Cordon Bleu's world-class instructors have taught French classical culinary techniques to everyone from home enthusiasts to food world legends. If you've ever dreamed of attending culinary school, maybe it's time to start living that dream. Check out one of Le Cordon Bleu's 35 locations around the world, or add a short vacation or weekend program at one of its schools to your next vacation. Visit cordonbleu.edu for course descriptions, dates, online registration, and to discover which school is best for you. It's all possible at Le Cordon Bleu. Welcome back to Radio Cherry Bomb. We are here with Kim Malik, the co-founder of Salt and Straw. So, Kim, you have rapidly expanded Salt and Straw since you opened back in 2010?
It was 2011. We started in 2010, but we opened in 2011.
Okay, in 2011. You're moving to San Francisco next.
Yes.
When will that shop open?
So we're hoping to open by mid-April, and the shop is at Fillmore at Sacramento. So it's Pacific Heights, a beautiful neighborhood.
Oh, fantastic. So that will be your 10th location overall. Mm-hmm. What have you learned? What are you putting into this 10th location that is the, you know, cumulative knowledge from all those other openings?
This location is kind of, it has a full basement. So we're able to have a little kitchen in the basement. When we opened in San Francisco, we're creating a whole different menu. And it's kind of a funny way for us to grow, because you would think that you would grow to kind of scale what you're doing and ship your ice cream from Portland or wherever you're manufacturing it. But when we opened in LA, we created a new menu there, and people really responded to it. And so we're doing the same thing in San Francisco. So we were lucky to find this space that has a kitchen in the basement, and we're going to manufacture there for the shop.
I have to stop you there, because you are basically for each new city doing completely different ice creams?
Yeah, I mean, we bring a couple of our favorites, so like our sea salt caramel and a few of those. I think there's like three or four that we'll bring, but everything else will be local. So Tyler has been working for about a year and a half, almost 2 years, at getting to know local artisans and farmers and collaborate on flavors with folks locally there in San Francisco. It's the ethos of who we are. And so instead of exporting our ice cream, we wanted to kind of export that idea. And it does seem a little crazy. It's really hard and expensive. I mean, ultimately, you know, when we open other stores there, we'll have to find a larger kitchen. And it's a huge investment for us, but we like doing it.
It's super cool. I mean, it's kind of nice, because, you know, you don't want to go to the same city and just find the same stuff everywhere. What's a particular Los Angeles flavor?
Well, we do a strawberry with avocado there. We do a goat cheese with candied olives. That's really delicious. We work with some local olive makers to do, or a walnut oil makers to do a walnut oil ice cream. We work with local chocolate makers and tea makers and cheese
makers. How wonderful.
And coffee roasters. And so the list goes on and on.
Can you give us a sneak peek of a San Francisco flavor?
Yeah. So, I mean, we've been working actually with the Berkeley Olive Grove. So we're doing some fun things with olives. My cousin was just telling me on the way over, and I wrote it down, that he is just meeting. He's there with, I don't know if I'm going to say this right, but a perfume maker.
Oh, Mandy Aftel?
Yes.
I love Mandy Aftel.
So he is working with her on some surprise things that are going to be coming out, and has been having a great time getting to know her. We're working with Sightglass Coffee, who's actually had an affogato bar using our ice cream there for a couple of years. So the guys who own that, he was my barista in Seattle, so we go way, way back. Dandelion Chocolate. There's just the community there has been really supportive.
That is such a fun approach. I absolutely love that.
Thank you.
So I wanted to go back to something you said when you had worked for Starbucks. You really appreciated the employees first, the people first kind of ethos of Starbucks. And that's something that you do for Salt and Straw. And I was reading something about how your brand is being recognized by Basic Rights Oregon. Congratulations on that. And it's because of this special training you do with your employees. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that the recognition is really for our employment practices. And they were struck. I think we've been getting to know each other over the past several years, and they've been supporting us when issues come up, and we've been supporting them with programs when Oregon was going through the Right to Marry campaign and things like that. Most recently, we were doing Valentine's Day was coming up. And it's such a goofy holiday. And we thought, let's turn this idea around love, really being about love for all. And so we did this campaign in our stores. It's one of the busiest days of the year for us, where we had photo booths set up and people could come and take pictures with signs that show their support of LGBTQ youth, just so they know they're not alone and we all support and love them. And so we were doing some public things like that. And then behind the scenes, all of our employees went through about 40 hours of training last year. And a big component of it is how to talk to and treat customers and other employees. We have a pretty high percent of folks who are going through transition, gender change. Mm-hmm. And we have a large number of folks, even in our leadership team, who are LGBTQ. And so it was just really important for us to be able to know how to handle that in the best way possible and create a supportive environment for everybody within our company. So, you know, it's everything from how to use gender neutral address someone, mm-hmm. when they approach the counter, all the way through, you know, how to help and support someone who's going through something, one of your coworkers.
And how did you get to this point as a business owner? Because obviously, when you had your little ice cream cart, you weren't thinking that far ahead. But how has this developed for you, where you got to the point you're like, I want to have this kind of training for my employees. I want to have this kind of business.
I mean, I think it was pretty organic. We opened our second store less than a year after we had our first. And so we were growing. And the hardest part of growing is finding great people. And I think, you know, we had all these opportunities and we have continued to have a lot of really good opportunities. And I think as folks came to us and were really talented, it was almost like more became more. And it seemed like a safe community where people have told me over and over that they can really be themselves and they feel accepted and supported and can thrive. And so as a result of that, when challenges came up and we were faced with situations that we didn't know what to do, we developed kind of these trainings to kind of help us all think through how this might work. So
how many employees do you have today?
After we open San Francisco, we'll have about 400.
Oh, what?
I know, it's a lot.
400 employees.
Well, we have about 25 in each shop, wow. And then we have about 30 plus in each of our kitchens. So.
And you have a mail order business because of Charlotte that you need to attend to. So you said the hardest part of growing is people, but the second hardest part of growing is finding money for that growth.
Yes.
You obviously have some investors now, because I'm guessing after tapping your 401k, there wasn't enough in that 401k to fuel 10 locations. Tell us about the process of finding investors.
Yeah, it was a kind of a funny thing. So I think our third and fourth shop and our kitchen in Portland, we were able to get by using SBA loans and some cash flow from the company. And when we went to open in California, we did have some bank funding available to us, but it seemed like such a big risk for us to be taking on this huge leap. And so I wanted to kind of take some of the pressure off somewhere. And so I started talking to a few different investors, and it was an interesting process. Because there were, you know, a couple of like friends of friends who had some cash and they were willing to support us. And then I got to know these guys who are kind of more industry people. And going through that decision-making process was interesting because, you know, going with kind of a larger sort of industry group might seem kind of scary and more formal. But every time I came away from those conversations, I felt really energized. And there were these great ideas and collaboration. And we just seemed to have really great shared values. And they could offer such amazing experience to us. And the other folks, it was like, okay, they have the money, but spent so much time educating them about what we were doing, and it just felt like a lot more of a drag. And so we ended up going in that direction. It was only about a year ago, and thank God, it's been a really good relationship, and I'm really, really happy.
What advice do you have for people looking to raise funds to expand their businesses?
I mean, I got to know these guys over probably a 2-year period or longer. And I would meet with them just every couple months here and there, wherever we happened to run into each other around the country. And I think that idea of having shared values is the most important, because you're inviting someone into your little business, and we have so much fun running this company, and we did not want to screw that up by having, you know, some investors that were pushing us to do things we didn't want to do, or kind of, you're going to hit hard times. And so having someone who's there and has your back and has the long view for us was really important. So that idea of finding shared values and good chemistry, I mean, these guys aren't like burn and churn and come in and, you know, turn things around. They're in it for the long run, and just really good partners from it. We have a shared vision for what we want in the long run, and they've been great.
You said when you hit hard times. Did you hit hard times?
Well, I mean, we opened 4 stores this year. So we doubled our size. And I'm really proud of, like, our product quality was excellent. Our team didn't miss a beat, and our people were phenomenal. We were able to hire at an alarming rate and train and get the right people in place. But behind the scenes, like, that comes at a cost. And so I think, you know, we were learning as we went, and, you know, those guys were really patient with us. So whether it's, you know, getting your new store opening costs under control, or, you know, just having the right infrastructure in place, it's like, oh yeah, I should have known that. I should have known that we needed that person, or we needed that firm or that resource, or we could have done that better. And now I do. So it's doubling your store sizes. I wouldn't advise that. It's hard.
But when you talk about having that infrastructure, you and I were speaking about it earlier, you know, you start a business, you don't necessarily know who you need or what you need. And you just have this romantic notion of, this is the business I'm going to start. And you're not thinking about regulations and taxes and accounting and lawyers and trademarking
HR,
and HR, all those things. And we share an accountant, Cohn Resnick. I'm going to make them sponsor the next season of Radio Cherry Bomb. I think they're a sponsor of Bloomberg Radio, so it's not
a stretch.
It's not unheard of.
No.
But you meet these people further down your path who you kind of wish you knew day one, because they'd make it so much easier. But when you're tiny, it's hard. You just don't necessarily know the right people or even the right questions to ask.
That's right.
It's like you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah. I mean, finding an accountant, believe it or not, was one of the hardest things to do. In our early days, we didn't have the right people in place. I remember meeting with this guy, and because I was cashing in my 401k, no accountant wanted to deal with me.
I did the same thing.
Okay, good. Yeah. So I'm not totally crazy. Well, I am maybe totally crazy, but that's okay. So I met with this guy, and I told him, I have this lease, and you know, here's what I'm doing. And he sat there quietly looking at me, and he said, well, I have one question for you. Do you have any way to get out of that lease? I was like, oh God. I mean, it's really hard to find the right people who will believe in your crazy idea and support you. And I think also there's that balance where, I mean, we wanted to be really careful with the limited funds we had and not spend too much by bringing on, you know, too many people or hiring, you know, these big firms or whatever. So it's really hard to know when you should do it and when you should invest. But if I had it to do over again, I would have put a few of those resources in place earlier, like a top-notch accounting firm, for instance.
Mm-hmm. I really want Riley, who's a lawyer we both know, and our accounting our accounting firm to do a seminar for Cherry Bomb, because I went to a seminar that they did in New York, and I think there were only like 5 women in the room. It was like me and Erin McKenna and Leah from Pig and Cow. I forget who else was there, but it really was like I could count on one hand. And it's you know, I hate to say this, but sometimes it's who you know.
Absolutely.
And when you don't know these people and you're not in the room where it happens, you know, like they say in Hamilton.
I did say that.
You miss out on some things.
Yeah.
And you miss out on certain networking and whatnot. So I've had that on my to-do list for a little while, but maybe you and I can now pressure.
I think that would be brilliant.
Gary and Riley, you know, to do that.
I even think, you know, when it comes to female entrepreneurs, I mean, I read an article recently, and this was so true of me, that, you know, if men have an idea, they walk around kind of very boldly talking about it. And if women do, they want to get it all perfect. And they really can be very nervous about bringing it forth. And then to get resources to support it is all that, you know, all the much harder. And so so I think that's a brilliant idea, just to put that right out there in people's faces so that they can take advantage of it.
I'm going to email them after the show. And
You're so smart.
I don't know that they listen to the show.
I don't know.
It's funny, I was going to mention my dad because we're talking about 401ks. My dad every like 6 months is like, what are you doing for your retirement plan? We've got to talk about your retirement plan. And I'm just like, oh my God, I need to tell my father I like dissolved my 401k to, you know, start a business. He's going to have a heart attack. But my father doesn't listen either. So
no, he doesn't need to know.
It's
that.
Okay. Yeah. All right. We have a few minutes left. I broke it to Dave, our engineer. We're not doing the speed round anymore. Sorry. Aww. I know. Sorry. I'll ask you my favorite speed round question later before we end officially. Okay. But yeah, it was just, I don't know. It's time. It's time. Has passed.
Something new.
We're going to think of something new for this summer.
I respect that, Carrie.
Thanks, Steve. Keeping it fresh.
You got it.
Keeping it fresh.
If anyone has a good idea, email me at info@jerrybomb.com because I don't have any fresh ideas yet, but I will by the summer. You're so chill. I can't believe it. I mean, you have this giant business, 400 employees. I didn't even know that. All these locations. And more importantly, you are the mother of three children.
Yes.
And you are still so chill.
Yes, we have three kiddos. Mike and I adopted them about 3 years ago. So it's been a really cool experience for us. Again, everyone said this was the worst time to do that, but they came into our lives at this moment. And so we went for it. And it's been so incredibly
fun. That's incredible. How did you make the decision to adopt?
You know, it was a funny story. Mike and I were kind of trying to get pregnant, mm-hmm. and it wasn't working. And one day he came home and said, you know, I saw this video of these kids who are up for adoption, and he showed it to me. And I said, you want to adopt? I wanted to adopt. And we'd never talked about it because we just figured the other person really wanted to have, you know, a birth child. And so I went into the bedroom and pulled down this secret shelf of books I had about adoption, and I put them down in front of him.
Oh, Kim, I'm going to cry. I'm really going to cry. You had this collection of books and you never told him?
I had never told him. Oh. And so, because I just thought, if he really wants to have, have kids together, then, you know, I want to do that. And so maybe we'll get around to the adoption thing later. And so we both realized that was our dream. And he really wanted to adopt in the United States because he had been in and out in foster care as a kid. And so that was sort of a new idea to me. And I mean to tell you, we put in our paperwork and within, I don't know, a couple weeks, these kids popped up.
So the children in the video are now your children.
They're not the kids from the video, but these other kids popped up. Yeah, they actually weren't available anymore. And I should find out where they are from the video. That's a good idea. So these other, there was actually a sibling pair we wanted to adopt older mm-hmm. children, a sibling set, and these kids popped up in Kansas City. We live in Portland, so that was kind of a funny thing. And then partway through the adoption process, we found out they had a little brother. So we got three. And it's been great. You know, Mike is African-American and our kids are. So it's been a pretty interesting experience for me the past several years, kind of being the only white person in my family and learning about that, especially during the current political times. But it's been a phenomenal experience.
Do you have any advice for women who are thinking about adopting, or any of our listeners thinking about that?
Yeah, I mean, we went through the state, and it was a really easy process. I mean, I know everybody says it takes forever and it's really intimidating, and I have to say it really wasn't. And there's also this kind of, rumor out there that kids in foster care, you know, or maybe can be really challenging. And there's a lot of great kids out there who just need a home, and they're just phenomenal kids. I mean, our kids are doing great in school. They have wonderful friends. They're, you know, playing sports, and we're kind of the all-American family in a lot of ways. And so I guess, you know, just kind of thinking about those stereotypes in a different way, I think could be really good for people, because it's been great for us.
And they have a beautiful mom who has an ice cream business.
It's like the cobbler's children, though. I never have ice cream. Jamari said to me the other day, you know, Mom, I heard at school some kids talking about this new flavor at Salt and Straw. Do you think we could try it? And I said, oh, God, I'm sorry. I'm a terrible mom.
That's pretty funny. Well, Kim, thank you so much for finding. I know it was kind of hard to find Roberta's. Thank you for coming here. Hopefully one of these days we'll get to hang out with you in Portland.
I would love that.
Maybe we'll get our little business symposium off the ground. Mm-hmm. One of these days, too. And I was going to ask you the one question from the speed round.
Oh, jeez.
If you had to be stuck on a desert island with one food celebrity, who would it be?
With one food celebrity.
Stumps everybody.
I think probably. Oh, now I'm freezing up.
First one that comes to mind. It's on the tip of your tongue. You forgot his name. Well, that's no help. Let me ask Dave. Will you think of a second person whose name you do know? Dave, who would you be stuck on a desert island with?
With you, of course.
So liar. Liar, liar. Who would
okay,
you?
Okay.
Oh,
right.
Kim. No, Kim's remembered. Dave, go ahead.
I really am totally, I've met this person, and uh-huh. he's super famous, and uh-huh. my mind has gone completely blank, and hopefully no one will ever tell him that this has happened.
Does he wear red Crocs? No, orange Crocs?
He does those crazy, like he was with Andy Ricker in Thailand and was eating.
Anthony Bourdain?
Yes. Because wouldn't he be the most fun if you're stuck?
I think he was our number one answer, Dave, right?
Oh, shoot. I'm not original.
Dave, you still have to answer.
Oh, I don't know. It's you.
Oh, stop.
Of course it's you.
Well, I wouldn't pick you.
Oh.
Oh, sorry. That was mean.
That was a total mom brain.
I'm also not a food celebrity. So.
Nah. Come on. You can pick anybody. Nigella, Martha, Alice Waters.
Nell Newman.
Okay, Nell Newman. That's a cool answer.
Yeah, she's really cool. We met her in San Francisco.
Okay. And Bourdain. Yeah, Bourdain would be a lot of fun. I think it would be a toss-up between Nigella and Bourdain.
He might be a handful.
Well, and plus it'd be great because it'd be a total surprise every day for me. I'd be like, what? Who are you? What is your name?
Oh, my God. Absolutely. All right, gang. That is it for today's show. Radio Cherry Bomb was engineered by the one and only Dave Tatasciore, who I would love to be trapped on a desert island with. Who am I kidding, Dave? Just in case your girlfriend's listening, I didn't want to fess up to that. Thank you to our sponsors for making this season of Radio Cherry Bomb possible. Be sure to have Kerrygold Irish Cream Liqueur on hand for all your entertaining needs. And visit cordonbleu.edu to learn about the variety of culinary classes offered at the legendary Le Cordon Bleu's many locations around the world. Thank you to Kim Malik for coming by today. Thanks to you for listening. You're the bomb.
Hi, I'm Paula Barbosa, founder and owner of My Sweet, an artisanal brand based in Bushwick, Brooklyn, where we make Brazil's favorite sweet, Brigadeiro. Radio Cherry Bomb is a joint production of Cherry Bomb Magazine and the Heritage Radio Network. To subscribe or learn more about the magazine, visit cherrybomb.com. You know who I think is the bomb? Raíza Costa is the bomb. Raíza is a super creative and fun pastry chef who started as a YouTube sensation, now has her own TV show and a cool new project on Food Network. She's also an incredible video maker who brings joy and lots of color to the kitchen.